Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is Friday, so on this show, that means it is Week in Review. Top of mind for so many this week is the novel coronavirus.
A virus like this is not deadly for the vast majority of people who may get it, but it is contagious.
That's Governor Charlie Baker updating the public just this afternoon with other state and Boston public health officials. So far, Massachusetts has 7 presumptive positive cases and 1 confirmed case. At the public update organized by the City of Boston, Mayor Marty Walsh says the city's focus is to keep the virus from spreading.
The best thing we can do today is work on prevention. And prevention is by doing all the things that have been laid out and constantly repeating to other people on what to do.
So here in studio to join us for coronavirus and our other Week in Review subjects is Michael Curry, WBUR political analyst, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
Also here in studio is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
And you, our listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join the conversation. We're going to start with coronavirus. And we're going to welcome a special ride-along guest this week. We want to have WBUR Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg join us. Carrie, welcome.
Happy to ride with you, Tiziana.
It's great to have you, especially because you were at today's press conference, right, Carrie?
Yes, I was.
All right, so let's start there. I think it's best that we do that. What was the takeaway today from the press conference, Carrie?
Well, first of all, it was what Mayor Walsh called an all-hands-on-deck press conference. It was everyone from the state and the city who you might expect. I'd say my top takeaway is that we do not have what's called community spread here yet, these officials say. Community spread where you don't even know where the source of the infections are. We do have those 5 new presumptive cases in Massachusetts stemming from a Biogen conference. And we found out today it was a Biogen leadership conference held last week at the Long Wharf Marriott in Boston. And health officials say they were over there this morning meeting with folks, and it has been doing a lot of deep cleaning, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
My other top takeaway is that state health officials say they're now doing 40 or 50 coronavirus tests a day, which is certainly more than before, but it still doesn't seem close to what is probably the demand.
So you gave us a couple of numbers there, Carrie, and in the lead at the top of the show, I almost hesitated because it feels like the numbers are changing so rapidly. So give us the snapshot of where we are in Boston and Massachusetts right now.
Okay. The snapshot is we have basically a handful, right? A trickle. So we have 1 confirmed case. That's the UMass Boston student who came back from Wuhan, and he has reportedly recovered. Then we have 7 presumptive positive cases. They probably are really positive. 5 from the Biogen meeting and 2 who were people who traveled to Italy. Now, state officials don't reveal where they live except for the counties. We've got Norfolk, Suffolk, and 1 in Middlesex.
Okay. So given that, what precautions are we hearing today that the city and the state are taking?
Well, actually, these are individual initiatives. A handful of schools have reportedly closed in Wellesley after a parent tested positive, in Plymouth, Hyde Park in Boston, Malden. In Boston, Mayor Walsh says the city is taking it very much day to day and kind of working out protocols. But my main impression from him was that we're not at that point yet in terms of calling off big gatherings or closing institutions. And he definitively said we're not at the point when we would cancel the Boston Marathon. Now, statewide, there's just a whole lot of preparation going on, hospitals and officials and all kinds of structures. One other bit of news is that the state has submitted a request for more personal protective equipment from the National Strategic Stockpile of Emergency Supplies, PPE, personal protective equipment. Those are the gowns and the masks and the face shields that are used by healthcare workers and others who have to be in contact with high-risk people.
Okay, so you've mentioned healthcare workers and hospitals. We do know that 4 staff members at South Shore Hospital who were in immediate contact with a patient diagnosed with COVID-19 in Norfolk County have been asked to stay home for 2 weeks, which they will do, right?
Right. And so, again, even though we have this handful of cases, even here in Massachusetts, it's getting hard to keep up with everything. All the places where there are possible cases, the latest measures and recommendations. Here's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh today.
This is a rapidly evolving situation. We want everyone to know that we are ready for a safe and effective response to what this information is coming out. It seems like every 10 minutes.
Does seem like every 10 minutes. I will say, Tiziana, to me, the most troubling question at this point is that there's still relatively little testing going on, and we don't know what we'll find out once we start testing more broadly. Could be there are a lot of cases here. Could be there aren't. There probably aren't. We just don't know yet. But it appears that the virus was circulating in Washington State for weeks before it was detected there.
Okay, last question before we open it back up to Tom and Michael and to our callers. Mm-hmm. To that point, what is the status of testing kits?
So there certainly are more than there were, and the tests can return results within 24 hours. Here's State Public Health Commissioner Monica Barrell.
The guidelines for who should be a person under investigation related to this have recently changed to be expanded to appropriately allow a clinical judgment to go into place so that if a clinician is seeing someone that they believe should be tested, that that would be accessible to them. With that change at the State Public Health Lab, still the only place in Massachusetts that can do testing, we have asked for and received from the CDC increased number of test kits to build up to that.
So bottom line, hospital and private labs haven't come online yet to do this testing. The demand is high. In general, testing is being confined to people who have symptoms.
All right, so let's open this back up. And 1-800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join the conversation about a strange week reviewing the coronavirus, of all things, here in Boston. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor, what's your reaction to everything you just heard from Kerry?
So it sounds to me like the city and state's response is pretty measured and pretty appropriate. They aren't panicking. They're not telling people not to get together. They're saying we're going to keep a watch on things. Appears to be a fairly high degree of transparency. Unlike, for example, the level of transparency we did not have in China when this thing first broke. I will say, on the other hand, I am seeing a lot of panic and overreaction out there. And to my mind, the most obvious overreaction right now is MIT, which just announced today that it's no longer going to allow gatherings of 150 people or more. Now, if there is a red line train going into Cambridge, I don't know if there's an MIT inspector now stopping that train from coming in because it has over 150 people or what they're going to be doing. But I have to say, this is really an overreaction. It's MIT sounding more like the Flat Earth Society than it's sounding like an institution that understands science and technology.
They're going to love you for that one, Tom. Michael, let me turn to you and ask you, one of the challenges in talking about a story like this is how much to talk about it. What is the right balance between giving people regular updates and not inducing a level of anxiety that is not appropriate to the moment we're actually in?
Well, it's interesting. I attended a hearing about 7 years ago. The state legislature had a hearing on emergency preparedness, and they talked about pandemics. And if you've ever sat through a terrifying hearing, it is a hearing in the legislature about pandemics. The number of people who get sick, who die, who the lack of access you'll have to hospitals and providers, it's real. And I think there's a need to have this conversation. I think this is a genuine exercise in responding to this particular crisis, but it could just be a warm up for the next pandemic as well, that we have a serious challenge in this country. And it was said at the hearing I attended. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. There is going to be pandemics in this across this globe. And I think there's an opportunity here to take this seriously. I thought that the mayor and the governor did do a great job of sort of managing everyone's expectations that we don't need to panic. You don't need to cancel everything. But the reality is this could get worse before it gets better.
Yeah. And you know, to add to that, the reason why things have changed is that this world of ours is vastly more interconnected.
Yeah.
That's what we're really seeing is so different from, say, 10 or 20 years ago. People travel all the time. Goods travel back and forth. Commerce at this point and industry at this point is critically dependent on parts made all over the globe.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, which Janet from West Tisbury is going to do. Janet, go ahead.
Hi. In all the coverage I've heard about the coronavirus, I have not heard any plans on how they're going to deal with the homeless people, either in Massachusetts or California, which has thousands. I mean, what are the plans for dealing with those people? How can you quarantine them?
It's a great question, Janet. Carrie, have you heard any discussion anywhere about Janet's question?
So I have heard concern, for example, at a legislative hearing this week where they were talking about the need for plans to help all the most vulnerable populations. There are people in rural settings. There are all kinds of people that with circumstances that make life more difficult. I would also say that you haven't heard about their plans because we haven't heard about their plans for anything. They're not telling us, for example, what would be the threshold at which we would say no more public gatherings, or not even at what threshold should a school close. And I don't know why these plans are held very close to the vest. I don't know if it's because they're still evolving or because they don't like to tell people in advance, but we're not hearing about the plans for anything, really.
Or Michael,
maybe
you're nodding.
They don't have them.
Let's hope not.
You know, I think part of the conversation is whether the funding's there to do what we need to do. And if you've sat through a legislative hearing, you'd find out we don't have the necessary funding.
You are like totally Debbie Downer today.
Well, and Mike, I would add, actually, what I heard the public health commissioner tell the legislative hearing was, we do have enough funding. I don't know how they define that.
So I think the challenge here is there are special populations, and I've always used this example of Katrina. This is a Katrina waiting to happen. If you have special populations, people with disabilities, people without vehicles, people who don't have insurance, homeless people, they are the people most vulnerable when a natural disaster, a pandemic, or a terrorist attack impacts our communities. That's a conversation that's been had in and about the Beacon Hill for years, but I don't know if we've had the unified focus, the centralized focus to really deal with those populations and what's necessary to make sure that they're not at risk.
And Tom Keene, let's talk about the money for a second, because today the president signed an $8.3 billion emergency spending bill, billions of dollars for the CDC to support public health agencies, federal, state, local level, $3 billion to research and develop tests, treatments, vaccines. Is that the right scale? Do we know? Is that going to be enough?
We don't know if that's the right scale, but here's my sense if you look at it from a political point of view. Donald Trump knows that this matters in terms of the November election. And if he gets it right, it's going to really help him a lot. If he gets it wrong, that's going to become a major plank for whoever is the Democratic nominee.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Janelle is on the line from Somerville. Janelle, pull up a chair with the panelists. What's on your mind?
So I'm just wondering, when thinking about incubation periods, like my two questions are, what do we know about that? And then what are we doing for when considering that time period between when someone is actually having it and then being diagnosed and all of the people they're coming in contact with?
Okay, so great questions, Janelle. Carrie, what do we know about the average incubation period for novel coronavirus to COVID-19?
So I would just say there's so much that we don't know yet about this virus. In general, we know that people are being told to self-isolate or self-quarantine for 2 weeks. We think that that's roughly it. There are also some initial indications that people can be asymptomatic, that they can carry the virus without and spread it without having any symptoms, at least some of the time. But I think this comes back to how the media should be covering this, in the sense that, you know, we have to distinguish between what we know is true. I don't think we know a true answer to that question yet. What we think is true, which is that it looks like it's a couple of weeks, give or take, and then otherwise it's opinions and speculation. So where we're at is that we're being told 2 weeks is the period for safety.
Okay, Michael Curry, I
learned a new term in the press conference today, social distancing.
Yes, yes. Stay away from each other is another way to put it.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's 6 feet away.
And that's why all of us have glass walls in between us. This is a new thing here at WBUR.
We're shouting over the top. That's right. Michael, to this point, in New Hampshire, the state's first patient went to an event in Vermont and infected at least one other person despite being ordered to self-quarantine. So, part one, do people really understand what it means to self-quarantine? And two, we're starting to have some civil liberties questions here, right? If people are like, yeah, I'm going to a party, at what point does it become necessary to think about more than voluntary self-quarantine? And how would one even do that?
Yeah, I think, you know, one, just the issue of, and it's funny, I was looking at a video of a friend who's in China right now and the restrictions. He lives in a housing development. He can't even leave his housing development without going through a checkpoint. And has to leave with a mask and all this protective equipment on. I think the liberties get curtailed in situations like this. Now, how much you do it and what's appropriate is always a challenge and debatable. But the reality is we get to a point, which we're not there yet, where you have, well, we could be with this particular example, where you say to people, you have the virus, we need you to stay home. And we need to make sure you stay home. I think it's in the public's best interest that that happen. And we need to take that seriously. If people don't take their own health seriously, then they may not take ours as well.
Can I ask you, what do you think the consequences should be for someone who does something like that?
Let's actually ask Tom to start. Yeah.
And let's think about it this way. Suppose you actually have someone who maliciously is trying to spread it. Suppose this is like the circumstance you had with some folks who had the HIV virus and intentionally went out and tried to spread it. It seems to me that in a circumstance like that, then compulsion should be an appropriate remedy. That, in fact, you can tell a person, we're going to make you stay at home or make you stay in some isolation.
My little Latin phrase, reducio ad absurdum, reduce it to the absurd. There are going to be examples. There could be examples where people are criminally liable for trying to infect other people. I think there's just people who have bad judgment, and we'll have to figure out how to deal with those folks. I don't have an answer for that now, but I think folks will have to get in the room and figure out what's a appropriate recourse for that.
I learned another term this week, spreader. So don't be a spreader.
Don't be a spreader.
Yeah. So a whole new lexicon that we're developing here. I want to take one more call.
Is that like man spreading? No, that's different. Okay.
It's virus spreading in this case. I want to take one more call on this and then callers heads up. In a minute, we are going to shift to a bunch of stuff on the MBTA. So get your dialing finger or your button pressing finger ready, or Siri, if that's your jam. In the meantime, Galen is on the line from Cambridge. Galen, go ahead.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you and your guests could talk a little bit about why they think this is inciting so much mass panic. Is it the rapidity of the spread, or is there something else? Are we just so used to not having to deal with this kind of thing and having access to, say, robust medical supplies or lots of Clorox wipes? I mean, we had the measles outbreak in New York, but that didn't spread as widely, but it could just as well have been as or more deadly.
So let's take it. I want to take it from there, Galen. I'm going to give it to Carrie. And Carrie, since this is the last word on this, also use that opportunity to remind us of who is at risk and what the basic personal prevention practices are.
Okay, so I would say, number one, it's unknown. The unknown is just so scary. Number two, it is appearing that it is much more deadly, or not much more, but significantly deadlier than flu. So you've got something like the flu, but it's deadlier. That's naturally, and it's infectious. That's also naturally scary. And I think we can all do a chorus of this right now. Wash your hands for 20 seconds. If you're sick, for the love of God, stay home. You know, keep a bit of a distance from anyone who might be sick, and just follow the public health instructions.
And just one important fact that I'd be remiss if I didn't say. The absence of the PPEs, the personal protection equipment, has an impact on providers. That if providers can't be protected themselves, you're going to have a capacity issue if you can't see patients because you don't have protective equipment. And I know that's a community health center concern. I'm sure that's a hospital concern. It's one we need to really be prepared for.
All right, so we're going to take a partial pivot here, because a related area is what the MBTA is doing to keep commuters safe. The T announced this week that workers will wipe down contact surfaces such as ticket gates every 4 hours and will increase the cleaning of trains and buses. And they aim to more frequently disinfect train cars and buses themselves. Here's Steve Poftek, general manager of the MBTA, earlier this week.
Subject to getting enough disinfectant in place, we are going to move to a protocol where we will be disinfecting every vehicle every day. Right now, we have enough equipment on hand to be doing that on the commuter rail. We expect by the end of this week to be able to do it across the system.
So I think one of the questions is, you know, is that reassuring? Is it proportionate? We actually already have a caller on this, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's hear from David in Lexington. David, go ahead.
Hi, I am an occasional user of the T. Used to be a more frequent user, but I do think that what the T is doing is a step, at least in the right direction, considering what's happened in Washington and even worse in Italy, where it seems like it got ahead of them. It might be better to be a little proactive, even if it's, you know, there's so much unknown about it. We just don't know what it really takes to keep it from spreading.
That's a good point, David. Thank you. And Tom Keene, I'm going to turn to you. one, are you reassured as David is? And two, you brought up the whole T point a couple minutes ago where there are probably more than 150 people on a T car. Should people be riding public transportation? And what on earth would they do if they shouldn't be riding
public transportation? So as I understand it, actually killing the virus probably takes more than a simple wipe down. And it's, I think what the T is doing is maybe as much as good public relations in terms of trying to say we're going to try to keep you safe. Because given the fear that is out there about this virus, I can readily see people electing not to take public transit and getting back into their cars and Ubers.
And which would, I mean, I can't even think about what that would mean for way of life and people's ability to get places and traffic congestion, et cetera.
We would be in cars for so long, we'd actually never have to show up at that meeting where we'd get infected.
We would be, what was the word you used? Socially
distanced.
We would be socially distanced.
That's true, social distancing.
WBUR spoke with a T rider, Scott Donahue Martins, and he said he's upping his personal hygiene game.
I usually try to wash my hands whenever I get to my destination after taking the T. I've also been cleaning my phone a lot more since I know that I usually will hang on to something with the T and then touch my phone. And so I don't want to increase my risk of having something passed from there.
Okay, so Michael Curry, well, the first thing that makes me think of is we're talking a lot about what we do to take care of ourselves. How are we talking about and thinking about what we do to take care of and be thoughtful about the other person? I mean, in a contagion, it's not just you who can catch it. You can give it.
Yeah,
and
so
you have
to think
about your neighbors.
I think, you know, it's interesting. That comes up most recently in the context of the masks themselves and how the mask may not protect other people, but it protects, well, let me say it this way. It doesn't necessarily protect you, but if you are sick, it can protect others from your illness. So I think there's a need to figure out how we can appropriately deal with our hygiene. I was in the bathroom earlier here in the studios and thought about washing my hand for 20 seconds. Of course, I've never thought about how long I wash my hand because the press conference today, I think it was Secretary Sutter's, talked about washing your hands up to 20 seconds in warm water. And the gentleman next to me was in the water a long time, too. And we looked at each other and we're thinking the same thing.
You're so both counting.
I think there's something that is a heightening of our consciousness about all the things we can do, cleaning our phones, washing our hands. Many people walk out of bathrooms, don't wash their hands. And quite frankly, holding the rails on the train, even if it's not the coronavirus, we're still spreading germs and illnesses, and we can minimize that by just operating differently. And again, it's a tee up for the next pandemic that might be more serious if we know how to operate.
So, Carrie, the other thing that I thought of in listening to Scott Donahue Martins, the tee rider we talked to, was the phone. I'm thinking about my hands. It's underwater for 20 seconds, but my phone is everywhere. How should we be thinking about this device we're carrying and setting down and touching?
And it's hard to put it underwater.
Yeah,
you can't put it underwater.
It doesn't go well.
Right. There are instructions about cleaning that are out there. The virus is killable, as I understand it. And I also find 20 seconds of washing your hands is this sort of meditative pleasure that I never used to do anymore. Now it's like this relaxing moment where I just enjoy it.
So, Tom Keene, one of the places that the corona, it's been a long week, the coronavirus is not being spread is on the new Orange Line trains on the T, which have been pulled out of service again.
Isn't that great?
Is that the upside? I mean, what is going on with these Orange Line trains? I think this is the third time they've been pulled out of service. They're relatively new. I know this is a pivot, but it's a thing. And we're already congested on the T. We're already struggling for transportation. Is it normal? Is this like the new model of a car? Or should people be concerned that these brand new trains are having this kind of
trouble? I wish I knew the answer, right? Because we've been making train cars for an awful long time. You know, they've got wheels and basically they're rectangular in shape. I don't see why it has to be that difficult. The cars are not that dramatically different from what we've seen before. So it truly is a mystery to me. You know, is this like, you know, the 747 Max or whatever, where, you know, there's some brand new technology? I don't think so. I think it's the same technology. And it really does beg the question about where was the quality control?
So, Michael Curry, I noticed in an article I was reading about this that the trains are being built at a factory in Springfield that was specially built, these train cars, but they come from a metal shell that is imported from a factory in China. And one of the things we've been hearing about, we had Evan Horowitz about this last week on our show, talking about the supply chain disruption that coronavirus is doing globally. Are we likely to see things like long-term capital improvement plans be disrupted by supply chain interruptions as this coronavirus continues to carry out?
Yeah, I think this is a reminder of how interconnected we are globally. And when we get our supplies and our parts and our services from other parts of the globe, that we are impacted when they're impacted. So I think, yes, that's true. I would also speak to the issue of, so we self-funded this, right? We got state money to purchase these new trains. We didn't use federal money. When I talked to Beverly Scott, she talked about, Beverly Scott, our former GM, and she would often tell me, Mike, the real issue is the workforce. Mm. That we don't have the workforce to repair these trains. And we've not invested in a pipeline of younger and folks who are trained in how to fix our trains and get them back on the tracks. That's a concern. And this may heighten our awareness about that as well.
Okay, we are on now to the week in Democratic presidential politics.
That's looking good. So I'm here to report we are very much alive. And make no mistake about it. This campaign will send Donald Trump packing.
But tonight, I tell you with absolute confidence, we are going to win the Democratic nomination. And we are going to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
I will not be running for president in 2020, but I guarantee I will stay in the fight for the hardworking folks across this country who've gotten the short end of the stick over and over. That's been the fight of my life, and it will continue to be so.
What a week it has been. Biden and Sanders are left standing after Super Tuesday, and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has dropped out. Tulsi Gabbard is still in it, but for all purposes, really, it's a two-person race now. And what do you think of that? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Curry, okay, end of the week, Super Tuesday. So much has happened.
It has.
Yeah, since last Friday. We were in an entirely different place.
Yeah.
Well, how are you reflecting on it?
Of course, after we all lick our wounds around the fact that there's not much diversity in this race, age, race, gender, and that we're back to sort of what we always have, which is white men. And we're dominated in the city level, state level, federal level with a dominance by white men that control our government entities. Once we get past that, the reality is I think we have two strong candidates that are now vying to be our Democratic nominee and two opposing viewpoints. And I think it's good for the party. It'll be an ideological conversation about how far we want to reach to do things like Medicare for All or access to colleges and free education. And then, more of a moderate approach. Do we work through the ACA and really build off of the Affordable Care Act? It's a good time. I do believe there's some rifts to heal with Senator Warren, some rifts to heal once the eventual nominee is set, that people don't walk away from the process. That's my biggest concern now.
So, Tom Keene, I'm going to grab a caller and give you a chance to respond. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Alosis on the line who is driving in Dorchester. Alosis, go ahead.
Yes. So my question is, I don't have a question. What I want to say is that I'm a Senate supporter, and I just got my citizenship until 2019.
You're a Bernie Sanders supporter, Alosis? Alosis, did you say you're a Bernie Sanders supporter? I just couldn't understand you.
Oh, no, yes, I'm a Senate supporter, and I just got my citizenship in 2019, so 2x2, that was my first vote. And I feel like the Democratic...
So, we're losing Alosis. We've got a bad line. But he had told our team what he wanted to talk about. So I'd like to pick up Alosis's point anyway, Tom Keene, which is he is a Bernie Sanders supporter and feeling like the system really is working against Bernie Sanders, that there is an establishment that wants Joe Biden and not Bernie Sanders in the general election. I want to give you a chance to react to Alosis's thoughts there.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, Bernie Sanders, most of the Democratic establishment doesn't regard Bernie Sanders as a Democrat because he is not a Democrat. I mean, he has historically been an independent. A lot of them would just glibly say, I want to vote for the Democratic candidate. That excludes Bernie Sanders. I think there is a perception on the part of a lot of Democrats that the lane he travels in, which is regarded as far left and as self-described Democratic socialist, is a lane that would lose this election in a historic manner, maybe along the lines of Nixon versus McGovern. That kind of sweep would allow Trump to return for 4 years. And and they are scared to death. Now, is there, you know, are there a bunch of sort of wise men and women sitting in a smoke-filled room making these decisions? I don't think so. I think a lot of what happened, including the way voters ended up flocking to Joe Biden, was very organic. I would point, if anything, to one man who had the most profound effect on this, and that is Jim Clyburn from South Carolina. He is the one who almost single-handedly changed the outcome of this nominating process.
Michael, you were nodding a lot.
Yeah, the Clyburn effect is real. I think Bernie is, and his supporters are right. I mean, systems do work against people, right? If they feel like you're not the right nominee, if you're not loyal to the party, no matter what party it is, of course that's true. It worked against Trump, and he won anyway. So I think that the reality is that's there. I would caution Bernie and his supporters, though, to not dismiss what happened on Super Tuesday, because that is a disrespect to those black voters in those states who showed up, and those Latino voters who showed up and put their support behind Biden. They did not do that because of the party. They do that because they know him, they trust him, and they believe he is the right candidate that can unseat this president from the White House. That is what we're looking at.
Now, you just talked about Bernie Sanders and his supporters, and I want to pivot to that for a second. Elizabeth Warren is out of the race, but last night she gave an interview to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, and she talked about some of the vitriol and hate that, in her view, stems from some supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders.
I think there's a real problem with this online bullying and sort of organized nastiness. And I'm not just talking about ooh, Sid mean things. I'm talking about some really ugly stuff that went on. We are responsible for the people who claim to be our supporters and do really threatening, ugly, dangerous things to other.
And it's
candidates.
It's a particular problem with Sanders' supporters.
It is. I mean, and it just is.
So, Tom Keen, one, do you agree with that? And two, what can a Bernie Sanders do about the behavior of those followers?
So, number one, I completely agree with it. I think Elizabeth Warren is exactly right here. I think we also saw the same phenomenon 4 years ago. It's the Bernie Bros phenomenon. Not only men, not only white men, but it is definitely seems to be a fanatic group of people who support him. Can you blame Bernie for this? And I guess I do. And I think I do because I don't see that same phenomenon with other candidates who hold very strong positions themselves. I didn't see that out of Elizabeth Warren's supporters. I didn't see it. I didn't see it out of Amy Klobuchar's supporters or Pete Buttigieg's supporters, or for that matter, Joe Biden's supporters. I listened to Bernie Sanders' speech on Tuesday night and compared that to Joe Biden's speech. Joe Biden's speech was embracing. It was a speech that was trying to be unifying. Bernie Sanders was clearly us versus them, the us being Bernie, the them being Joe Biden.
All right. We only have a couple minutes left on this subject, and the lines are full. So I want to get a bunch of caller voices. We may not be able to address everything they raise in their calls, but it'll give us time to react to a few things. We've got Dave on the line from Millbury, Massachusetts. Dave, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know if Bernie supporters don't get Bernie as a nominee, where do you think the Bernie supporters will go? And I'd like to know, is all the black voters going to Biden, or is there any black voters going to Sanders?
Okay, great. Let's take Susan from the Back Bay as well. Susan, go ahead.
Oh, hi. When you were talking about being down to a two-man race, I'm fearful the next couple of months are going to have Biden and Sanders slashing at each other when their real target should be attacking Trump. And I think people tend to lose sight of that.
Okay, and let's pick up one more. We've got T in Canton. T, go ahead.
Yes, there's this talk about the lack of diversity among the candidates. And I think when it comes to politics, diversity of thought is much more important than the color of someone's skin or their sex. And in that regard, I think Bernie Sanders is definitely the most diverse candidate we've had, at least in my lifetime.
Okay, T, thanks for that. And I want to pick up just one more. Renato, very quickly. Renato in Mission Hill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to say that Sanders actually won the Latino vote overwhelmingly nationally. And there's this narrative that he's not picking up any black voters, but why isn't there a narrative for Biden not picking up the Latino voters?
Thanks for that. Thanks, Renato. So lots to work with there. Yeah. Michael, yeah. just take a couple reactions and then Tom,
round.
I'll do to you.
Yeah, yeah, so I think, one, that's true, that Bernie did pick up a lot of Latino voters, particularly in the Southwest, West Coast with California. It's true. That Latino voters, whether it's the union issues, his stance on immigration policy, I think he did a good job and he had traction and some resonance with those communities. Black voters, in large part, if you look at any of the polls in the Clyburn effect, I'll call it, he did very well with the black community, especially in those southern states. So that is true. The only thing I'd say to that is Bernie and Biden and black voters, we're voting on who primarily will unseat Trump. And that is the number one factor. There's a lot of stuff with criminal justice, education, housing that's sort of secondary. We are traumatized as African-Americans and communities of color by this president. And he has to go. And I think that's playing out in our votes.
Tom Keene.
Yeah, I think that's right. One of the callers had talked about how the two candidates, Biden and Sanders, really need to be focusing less on each other and more on Donald Trump. And I really do share that fear of the caller that they're going to tear each other down, particularly in terms of the language I heard out of Sanders, that it will be destructive to ultimately the ultimate mission, which on the part of the Democrats is defeating Donald Trump.
All right. So I want to take that moment. I do want to bring Donald Trump's voice in for a minute. And I want to do it in a specific way because we have not talked about the gender dimension of Elizabeth Warren's run and her need to pull out of the race. This is President Trump today after he signed the coronavirus bill into law. He was asked by a reporter if sexism played into Warren's exit in the primary.
No, I think lack of talent was her problem. She had a tremendous lack of talent. She was a good debater. She destroyed Mike Bloomberg very quickly, like it was nothing. That was easy for her. But people don't like her. She's a very mean person, and people don't like her. People don't want that. They like a person like me that's not mean.
So,
well, he is a great, you know, he is a really such a great commentator on stuff. Clearly the
and
best,
he always knows what
the
he's
best
talking
political
about.
Pundit we have in America. I don't even know why we're talking here.
We're talking about his hunches. Why don't we talk about his hunches around the coronavirus?
So as we move to our hubbubs, I do have to say that was a bit of a laundry list of what a lot of people say are the attitudes that are keeping women from being able to be successful in the race. And it was kind of a microcosm of that. All right. Before we run out of time, I do want to end with our hubbubs. Those are the local stories events that caught our attention this week. Tom, I'm going to have you go first.
Okay. So this Sunday at 2 a.m., clocks will spring forward, ushering in daylight savings time and losing us an hour. Folks will arrive at work Monday bleary-eyed and cranky, if they arrive at all. The switch to daylight savings time is also associated with an increase in automobile accidents. Indeed, health experts say it also increases the rate of heart attacks and strokes. So why do we bother doing this? Right now, we're in so-called standard time. I say so-called because standard time only began November 3rd, and with this weekend switch, will have lasted just 126 days. That's just about a third of the year. Hardly standard. And for that third of the year, by the way, our afternoons are far darker than they need be. So why don't we just bite the bullet and make daylight savings time year-round? If need be, Massachusetts can go it alone. Worst case, we'd be out of sync with our neighboring states for about 4 months each year. And my guess is, once they see how much better off we are, they'll follow suit.
Okay, you kind of had me at hello on that one. Michael, what's your reaction to Tom?
I think it's an excellent one. I would add one, which is Spencer Confidential, which is a Mark Wahlberg series that'll run on Netflix. And it's an interesting story, another story about Boston bars and fights and shootings and stabbings and so forth.
Such an unusual story to tell about Boston.
It's interesting. The plot is Spencer Confidential begins and the ex-Boston cop Spencer Wahlberg plays him. Completing a five-year prison stint in Walpole for beating up a corrupt police captain. It is modeled in some ways after a show I used to love called Spencer for Hire.
Oh, yeah.
People remember Spencer. And for those of us who love television and love characters, Hawk on that show was one of the best characters
I agree.
That
ever
is so true.
In television, way before Samuel L. Jackson sort of took that kind of role. But this is modeled after that. I think people might find it interesting.
I was always a big fan of the Robert Parker books.
Exactly.
All right. So mine is both sad and heartfelt. You guys know that I like to do hubbubs that have to do with animals. Any chance I can, I will. And this week, Rhett passed away. And Rhett was the unofficial Boston Terrier mascot of Boston University, where WBUR is housed. He was a Boston Terrier that was owned by two alumni. guy who bought him in 2008. He would walk the campus with his owners in his little BU sweatshirt, and students would stop and take pictures with Rhett and pet Rhett. He would give kisses. He was almost like a little therapy dog and mascot. He was diagnosed with a heart problem last year. I lost my last dog at the same age that Rhett's owners lost him from heart difficulties.
Wow.
My heart goes out to them.
Absolutely.
And to the campus for losing sweet little Rhett, the unofficial mascot at Boston University. All right, Michael Curry, WBUR political analyst, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National Board. Thanks for being with
us. Always a pleasure.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Love having you. Thanks for being
Delighted
here.
Delighted to be.
There's a lot going on in the world of sports, and I want to check the score with you, Chris Siderick. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now, listeners, you might remember that Chris, several months ago, swore that he was going to turn me into a Bruins fan.
And
this
I've heard
season.
You kind of talking around the office. It's slowly creeping in there.
So let's check in on it.
Last night's game, I think, was a perfect example of why I think this team is going to bring you on the bandwagon. They're in Florida. They're taking on a Panthers team that's pretty desperate and hungry. They put up a great first period and then kind of fall behind in the second, 1-0. They rally back, tie it up, and then win in overtime, 2-1. And that is despite the fact that even head coach Bruce Cassidy admits they did not have their best effort last night.
I didn't think we had our best. I thought it was our B game for the most part. A good start, kept it clean in the first and didn't generate a lot, but usually on the road, you want to make sure that you're not loose. We weren't. But after that, I thought we weren't able to execute.
So there are a couple of terms in there I want to kind of draw attention to because I think they're kind of interesting. He said they kept it clean in the first. Now, we've talked about hockey as a game of motion, right? That you've got three guys up front, two guys in the back, but kind of depending on how things move around, you're going to fill in and make sure that you're covering each other's backs. So he said, we made sure we weren't loose. That means you're nice and tight with your motions around the ice. Kept it clean. They didn't make any turnovers, bad passes, kind of give the puck away in the wrong zone. And they didn't generate a lot. He means they didn't generate a ton of scoring chances after that first period, but they were able to make it count when they did. What are you laughing about?
You are totally cracking me up. So here you're trying to prove to me that I'm going to love the Bruins. And one, you give me an completely unintelligible set of comments from the coach where you have to literally then explain to me what he said, except the parts that I did understand were not our A game. We weren't able to execute. So how is this supposed to convince me?
Well, I think it speaks to the character of this team because it's easy to win when everybody has their best night, right? There's 82 games in the regular season for a hockey season.
Mm-hmm.
We're all human. You can't possibly have your best night 82 times over the course of a season. So there are going to be nights.
Or 82 shows, as I showed just before
that's
the break.
That's right. But you still have to win even when you're having one of those off days. And so I think the fact that they're playing a desperate opponent, even knowing they're not having their best night, they lose one of their top defenders. But Torrey Krug is able to come in and score the game winner in overtime. And he admitted afterwards that they had to really kind of battle through to get it done.
We're trying to every night obviously bring our A game. If you don't have it, you got to live with your B game and live with the results. And obviously if we can win with that game, then it's a sign of a really good team. So we got the win and we'll move on and look forward to Tampa on Saturday.
We call that winning ugly in sports.
Right.
Even when it's not pretty, you get the win done. Big game against Tampa on Saturday. Tampa's coming to town. It's kind of their top competition in their division. The Bruins beat Tampa in Tampa 2-1 on Tuesday. And this is likely a potential playoff matchup. So big game coming up on Saturday.
All right. So why is a team that can win ugly the thing that's going to capture my heart?
Well, I think it speaks to the character that you're not willing to quit. It's easy once you realize you're not having a great night, the other team takes a lead. It's easy to give up at that point. You could just kind of mail it in, kind of coast through the rest of the game and go home. They have a comfortable lead right now. They have the best record in the NHL, most wins in the NHL. So they could have just taken that night off, said, it's not our night, we'll come back the next one. And they didn't. They battled through. They were aggressive early. They outshot Florida 12-4 in that first period. And as I said, they lost Brandon Carlo during that game to an elbow to the face. That we'll have to keep watching. We're not sure if he has a concussion or not. That could be a big loss. He's a big contributor. But just look at that overtime period, because you've got 5 minutes of 3-on-3 hockey, which means there's so much more room to operate. Guys are flying around the ice.
So you mean literally are only three players from each team on the ice?
Not counting the goalie, yes.
Okay.
And so they do that to basically create more space, which creates more exciting scoring chances. And basically gets the game over sooner once you get to overtime. You want to make it a little easier to score. And you kind of saw that in the overtime last night. It was back and forth and back and forth. At one point, with 3 minutes to go, Torrey Krug shoots on goal. Bobrovsky makes a huge save, and all of a sudden, the puck starts heading the other way. It's Alexander Barkov, one of the league's better scorers. This is what that sounded like.
Krug drives a save, and here comes Barkov with the game on his stick. A save by Halak! Jaro Halak with the save of the night!
See, you're smiling. I'm bringing you in little by little.
Well, if nothing else, I love the idea that somebody can have the entire game on their stick.
Well, and that's what it's like. He's got a wide open lane to the net, and generally that's kind of advantage scorer at that point because he can make a ton of moves. I thought it was really interesting. So Jaro Halak is the backup goalie. Tuukka Rask is the starting goalie. So Halak's in net last night, and he told reporters after the game that he knew exactly who it was charging down the ice at him.
I knew who it was, so he's one of the best in the league. On breakaways, I just tried to stay with him, not to make the first move. And, you know, I don't know who was backchecking on that one, but did a good job trying to get him and didn't give him time to make any moves.
So a couple of things I love there. I love that he sees Barkov coming. He says, oh, this is Barkov. I got to really be on my game here because this guy can score. But I also love this idea of not making the first move. And that's really what it's all about as a goalie in hockey. If you commit to one side or the other, all of a sudden you leave a ton of open space for him to shoot. And so it's just kind of riding out, watching him come further and further, closer and closer. It's hard not to bite. And he mentioned back-checking. I'm going to give you a little hockey 101 here. So that's the Bruins player who is chasing Barkov down the ice, just making sure he can't have free range and kind of do whatever he wants, spin moves, deeks, whatever.
All right, so here's my question for you. So you say that we've got this team that is getting it done right now. Everywhere I turn in Boston right now, the Boston Bruins are not what we're talking about. I'm hearing about the Red Sox, and I'm hearing about Mookie, and I'm hearing about Chris Sale, and I'm hearing about the Pats and Tom Brady. Why are they not getting the love they deserve as the Bruins, do you think?
It's a phenomenal question.
Thank
I think
you.
Partially, we like to complain here in Boston, right? We've had it so well over the last 20 years in terms of sports. We like to complain. So, Brady's probably going to leave at this point. The Sox look like they're a dumpster fire. So those are kind of more interesting. I have found it interesting. None of the sports stations in towns are talking about the Bruins. And this team has the best record in the NHL. They went to Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals last year. And they look like they're poised to make another deep run. So I think that's really interesting. They're also kind of counterintuitive. When you go that deep in the playoffs, generally speaking, the next year is a down year because you played all these extra games. Playoff hockey is super intense, so it takes a huge toll on the body. And you just kind of expect these guys to not quite have the fire or the hunger that they usually do. It's the same roster as last year, and that wasn't quite enough to get it done. So I think a lot of people thought, well, they're not really going to be serious title contenders this year. It's getting pretty hard to deny that this team could make a real run at the Cup again.
All right, you are starting to sell me. We do have about a minute left, and I do feel like we do have to talk about some of the other Boston sports teams. There is other stuff going on.
There is, and this would be the moment you want me to talk about Brady or Red Sox, but I'm not going to do it because there's another Boston team poised to make a playoff run, and that's the Celtics. And I think it's so exciting to see Jason Tatum, who had his 22nd birthday a day ago.
That is so young.
Yeah, put up team high 32 points against the Cavs on Wednesday. He has become a true superstar. And I'd say one of the 10 or 15 best players in the league, which in the NBA, it's such an individual sport. You need that talent to really be a true title contender. Jason Tatum, if he can play like this consistently, looks to be one of those guys that you can truly build a franchise around.
All right. Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek, thank you for checking the score.
Thanks for making time for me. I had to twist your arm a little bit. We got it done.
You're going to keep me in the game.
That's right.
All right. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sidorek, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I happen to be Tiziana Deering, and we all hope that you will join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.